At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around the iPhone. Get your grandma out of the bedroom and bring the iPad and listen to another podcast of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob and Bruce.
Bruce Heischober sticking around. Yeah, good times. Yeah.
It's better when we have a bunch of people on.
I think it is. Apparently, it's not just you and me. So one of the things that a lot of the questions, this is a show dedicated to emails and questions.
There's 20 million drug addicts out there, so well, I'm sure there's some questions.
What do you think about the new laws in California for recreational pot?
Well, first... There's two things going on, two things I view it as. One is a lot of the rehabs are going bust and everybody calls me for a job and I'm very codependent with clinicians and I'm trying. It's been going on for like 8 months now. Places are closing up, right?
Yep.
So I came up with this idea that the legalization of pot is going to lead to a lot of DUI arrests and I can get those KDOT counselors some jobs in the courts. We're going to have to look at it as an alcohol problem in California.
Yeah, same.
It's not. They're not tooled yet to do it. How do they test for it?
Part of the problem is how do they even determine driving under the influence? In other words,
that's what I'm saying. How do they test for it? If you're stoned and driving right now, Bruce, what happens? How do they know whether you're stoned or not? Because you have a breathalyzer for alcohol.
Well, no. At what point does it impair driving?
Right.
That's
when
somebody's
eyes are red and they're going 28 miles an hour in a 45, they're fucking stoned and shouldn't be driving.
Well, but they may be safer. Maybe they're a safer driver at 20 and a 45. I don't know. That's the point. Is at what point does it impair functioning? And it doesn't impair vertebral function. I mean, vestibular function and cerebellum. So a field sobriety test, they should be fine, even if they're super stoned, right?
Except I read one study, coordination is perceived when someone drinks, there's a better perception of when they're not in control or when the coordination is impaired.
But a
24-hour period past where someone will say, now my coordination is what it was before, and they did a test and they found that it took 24 hours until the coordination.
This is for alcohol?
For cannabis.
Well,
so
the problem with alcohol is not coordination, though. It's problem solving. And solving in a novel situation. In other words, one of the biggest impairments is if something comes at you that you've never seen before, trying to figure it out and work through it, like a car accident or something,
they're very impaired at that.
And the reason but how why do you test that?
The reason why we need to talk about it as Californians is we don't want to do something that harms others, right? The only way I see pot harming others is not the harm that alcohol does, which is violence, physical violence.
Right.
But it's driving. I'm really concerned about what's going to happen this year.
The first year especially when people are stoned out of their minds driving.
Well, what's Colorado done? That's what I don't know. Have they? I know they've been more driving the influence sort of arrest, but what do we do with – how do they determine that? How do they find them even?
There's a course
that law enforcement can take, and it's a substance abuse recognition course, and they do a combination of field sobriety testing, looking for nystagmus.
It's mostly the eye movement,
right?
Most of the nystagmus,
right? And so I think that's the first test that they're going to rely on. They're trying to develop something that gives you a differential between chronic use and acute intoxication.
What difference does it make?
Well, and they just want to look for something that's equivalent of a blood
alcohol.
Well,
you know, you
want
to know the old junkie. Wait, I want to answer Drew's question. Yeah. The old junkie in me says the person that's a chronic user of pot is probably a safer driver than the young 17-year-old who just got wasted.
I think most of the accident victims in Colorado are pot vacationers, people that just go there and they want to start using when they get there.
Right.
I think the concern
But there's not an age bracket. I think younger people.
Oh,
you know,
sure. My concern is when you drop the drinking age from 21 to 18, it affects teenagers. There's more access.
Yeah.
And now that it's available for recreational use,
At
I've already 18, seen this.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's 21. But still, I think there's going to be much more abuse in the teen years, and that's where the problems.
But wait a minute. So the existing medical marijuana laws exist still, right?
Yep.
So 16-year-olds have medical marijuana cards. They're getting marijuana anyways.
No, 18.
No, mom can consent. I had a client whose mom went and signed him up for it.
It's crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
Because right. They think of pot as harmless, and at least he's not on heroin, and he does it only in the house. This gets to parenting.
I'm just saying, to me, it goes to practice of medicine. That's horrible medical practice. Horrible. Right?
Yeah. Pot for anxiety? I almost thought it was bad.
In a 16-year-old? How about the fact, have any of you ever treated a patient in the last 10 years that is a drug addict that didn't have a marijuana card?
Oh, yeah. No, they always have them.
Yeah, that's the point.
So as a drug addict, you want to nail down all your opportunities.
I'm just saying that to me shows how horrible the medical practice is, where they don't even ask questions about drug addiction. They don't even screen for it.
Well, I think they choose to see what they see. They see the where it's benefiting people and older people.
Are you talking about physicians that do the recommendations?
The card.
I was approached to do that, and I said, obviously, no, but I looked into the rules. The rules and regulations for physicians are that before you can provide a recommendation, you have to show at least 1 year of failed treatment by conventional medical practice.
Oh, but that's for treatment of addiction.
No.
No,
if you come in to get a card.
Anxiety or depression. For anxiety.
To get
or
a recommendation. So a physician is affiliated with the clinic.
Got it.
And so you have to bring the record, spend it. It would take an hour with the physician. I have five kids going in, five 18-year-olds going in, and a nink and a
right, so they're not practicing medicine.
No.
That's my point. It's horrible medical practice. Horrible.
It's not medical practice.
Yeah, well, that's what drives me insane about it. I don't mind medical marijuana. I mind the people that are distributing
but
it.
But my prediction is there's going to be a lot of car accidents, a lot of stone drivers.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be good in one way is a lot of my people that I've mentored and stuff are losing their jobs because the out-of-network rehabs are closing one after another because the insurance industry contracted payment, right? First, I forget who did it first, then United did it. And so these rehabs are going out of business, which is good. They're all greedy fucks that shouldn't be in business.
Right.
But I feel for the staffs of those rehabs. So I feel like we as Californians have to decide what is stoned, what is a DUI when you're stoned, and we need to have treatment options, alternative sentencing, Drew, in that respect. That's
got
to come.
I think drug courts work.
I do, too.
Why there aren't more drug courts.
I had drug court. It's what got me sober. Right?
Yeah.
So I had drug court before there was a drug court. There was just a judge who really cared a lot.
What about the argument that where marijuana is made more available, heroin addiction drops? Have you heard that argument?
I've heard that.
Yeah. I think.
Have you seen that?
No. Well,
I've heard it.
We don't have enough time to see it, but
it makes sense that will happen.
Well, I think we need to do a better job. I know this sounds crazy that Bob's saying this. We need to do a better job at the access to opiates in this country in general and California in specific. So I'm not saying we need a war on drugs about heroin and all the what we criminalize everything, but we need to do what we're doing, which is the national data bank, and stop all this opiate prescribing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a sin that the people who really need opiates aren't getting them either, but there's always fallout from chaos, right? So a lot of the people that do need opiates aren't going to be able to get them. Because we're limiting for the greater good of the society.
I've got news for you. The goal within the next year or two, and a system, I won't mention its name, that I work with, is zero for everybody. Everybody on opiates is taken off opiates.
Crazy, right?
Not for post-surgical opiate, right? Post-surgical.
Right.
No, talking
but for
pain
chronic
management.
Pain, non-cancer pain.
Well, there is zero evidence that it's a treatment for that. Zero. Bob, zero.
I know, but you're talking about like
Bob?
My mom's friends are like 68. They've been on opiates for 10 years. What are you going to do? Have them detox and go to rehab? That's not going to happen.
That's right.
We've got a problem here. It's multi-tentacle. But the good news is I think that we have, as a society, have to say, what is too stoned to drive? And we haven't even said that yet before we fucking legalized it.
Look, same thing with pharmaceutical agents. We don't have strict criteria in that either.
But the good news about opiate prescription, opiate addicts, they don't really want to go anywhere. People stoned on pot want to go to the beach and go to a concert. And I think there's going to be a lot of car accidents and trouble from that.
I think so.
All right, let's get some of our emails. This is what we promised to do here. What is your take? There was a ton of questions about trans and trans therapy, transgender folks.
Well, Shelley has a treatment center for it.
I know. So, well, here's a question. What is your take on the use of hormone replacement therapy in trans children and teens? I'm a therapist, and I've recently been questioning my ability to be most helpful to trans clients. Many times they present with trauma, but insist on avoiding it and focus on just getting a letter for their hormones. That is heartbreaking to hear that. I don't know what to do with that. Hold on a second. That would be on her part, gross negligence? Or his part?
I'm saying to do hormone therapy without extensive psychotherapy or evaluation before you start that in a child or an adolescent.
I can't believe you wouldn't treat the trauma, even if you were going
to agree. It's too hard. This gets to a point you make. Trauma takes years.
It can.
And talk therapy, and it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. Hormones cost $80. Which do you think our system wants to do?
I just feel for this
therapist. I'm not being cynical, but...
No, but who monitors that? Where's the oversight?
Yeah, I think this therapist may have to recuse him or herself from this whole situation. If you're unable to do what you think is proper for the patient because of a system or a philosophy or somebody else, other doctor forcing
you... But a doctor's always going to trump a therapist.
I understand, but this therapist should recuse him or herself then.
Shouldn't they fight the good fight and say, hey, you know, once in a while, fight the good fight? They shouldn't do that?
Yes, to see if you can get the patient treated, the trauma, and then let somebody else make decisions about...
Why is that an either or?
No, well, that's what I was saying. You should treat the trauma. I mean, if you're a therapist. We have any feelings about that?
No, but I know what she's going... She or he... See, I assumed that it was a female therapist. I know what they're going through, which is the client wants you to reassure them that what their doctor is telling them is the right thing to do. And you're put in this bindy, bad spot, right? Because it seems like we're working together. You doctors are working with us therapists in coalition together, when if you disagree with what the doctor's doing, Drew...
Yeah.
What do you do? And the patient's looking to you to bond with more than with the doctor who's
the therapist. I'm just generally troubled with the idea that we don't do the hard work on behalf of patients.
No, we don't.
That's what bothers me.
Well, the cost effectiveness of it, and it's hard.
Yeah.
But that's insane. That's like just giving Suboxone to an opiate addict and do nothing else.
Right. I mean, that's right. Exactly
response.
Well, no, I know exactly what they want, and what they want is the therapist just to reassure the kid and everything's good and everything's okay. There's a lot of political correctness and touchiness to this subject, and the therapist is really not supposed to go at the family. What the hell's going on in the family?
They're not supposed
that
to
this 14-year-old girl wants to become a boy.
But
there's that's a no-go zone, Bruce, in this world.
But Bob, you're not supposed to do any of the customary treatment that you would do in any other situation. It's somehow that what this therapist is suggesting is that the point that you diagnosed transgender and want to treat it hormonally or surgically, you cannot do any other treatments.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
You don't do family treatment. You don't do trauma treatment.
You want to do
usual psychotherapy.
Psycho-support therapy, which is just you're doing the right thing. Good job, like a cheerleader.
Yeah.
You start the hormonal therapy, you shouldn't do anything else.
That's what this guy's suggesting. So
in other words, if you do start the therapy before, then you may be accused of trying to change.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
That's insane.
Exactly. All right, I'm 45. I have low libido. My doctor said they would not put me in hormones due to high cholesterol. I have always had high cholesterol. The doctor said I should get back on the statins. They will do the hormones. Yes, that sounds just. You should be on the statins with or without the hormones. I think the doctor maybe just be using the hormone as leverage to get you to do you need to do to save your life from heart attack and stroke.
The testosterone cream does the same thing.
Yeah, anything that raises your testosterone level can affect your vascular. It has effect on the lining of the arteries.
The cream is less though, wouldn't it be?
Bob, what are you saying?
You tried to get me to do the cream a couple months ago, and I looked into it, and I was like, I don't want that stuff.
It's the blood level. It's the blood level, however you get there. Whether you get it through your skin or for the shot, blood level.
It's like shooting heroin or smoking it.
Yeah.
They're both good.
I'm a 46-year-old female. I recently tested for a low platelet count after suffering from
yikes.
A 21-day heavy menstrual cycle. So she was having heavy menses because her platelets were low. Is this cycle causing the low platelet? No. Or the reverse a possibility? Yes. What other tests should I ask for? I'm worried about bone marrow. She's 46. Definitely get a bone marrow immediately. humbly, I would say. What would you say?
It's usually what, ITP or TTP?
Immune thrombocytopenia purpura, not TTP.
You guys
ITP.
Are doctor talking now. All bring right, it so, down to me. But, so I had a friend who had the platelet thing, but they're usually in their late 70s.
No, you can get all well, you late 70s, it. You worry about much more serious stuff.
Because they can bleed out.
No, it's because it's more associated with cancers and leukemias and lymphomas and stuff. But in like, who's the lead singer of Korn?
Jonathan.
Jonathan had this when he was in his late 20s. And you
really?
Put him, yeah. And you put him on steroids and it goes away. And it's usually
self-limited. No, you put him on steroids, it goes away?
Corticosteroids. ITV. Prednisone. Not anabolic steroids.
No, I'm not thinking that. I know prednisone. But so how does that get your platelets to go away?
Your immune system is attacking the cells that produce the platelets, the megakaryocytes in the bone marrow. And it's usually self-limited, in my experience.
Right.
And it goes; it gets better by itself.
Prednisone's a magic drug, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it was on the cover of Life magazine as that. This is the miracle drug. And they didn't know about all the horrible side effects.
What are the horrible side effects?
Your
I've been
skin
on
raise
it two
your
times.
Diabetes, cataracts, osteoporosis.
And especially in women, osteoporosis, it'll just erode your bone.
Like well, crazy.
But usually you just use it for like 2 weeks or
but
a month.
But they found even a single course, there's measurable effect on bone. Especially
bone.
Oh, my
God,
thinning.
The lawyers must be salivating.
No.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It depends on the category.
Huh? They don't know. I mean, it's not something people sue over.
It depends because they get the fractures 15 years later. They don't often associate it with it. But I will tell you, I have African American male patients that have to take steroids for various reasons, and they do not have demineralization. So if you're an Asian female, you're in trouble.
You're in trouble.
It depends on your ethnic and genetic and body habitus, I think, because they're more calcified. I mean, they're more mineralized. All right, here we go. Hello, I believe I'm suffering from postpartum depression as well as bipolar. Well, we don't know which. I'm extremely overwhelmed and need help at an inpatient center. Well, they want specific referrals.
Can we talk about another postpartum depression thing that I don't think is postpartum per se, but it's something that's going on in our society because I watched it and a couple friends of mine and with Chrissy, my wife, right?
Yeah.
People think that being a parent is going to transform their existence and bring meaning to it,
yes.
And it doesn't.
Makes it worse. Makes it more stressful.
Well, nobody talks about that.
Oh, please. Parents do, don't they? It's before the parenting that you need to talk to people.
You need to forewarn them.
Yeah.
This is not going to be a transformative thing. This is kind of a pain
in
the ass.
That's why I got involved with Teen Mom. That's why because I knew that the young people would relate to that and see it then. You can't tell them that. They have to see it. They have to experience it.
But I think that there's a lot of people looking for meaning in our American society, and they're thinking that having a family will bring meaning, not the role that stewarding children are as the meaning. They want a real bang for your buck meaning.
Well, isn't a corollary that having a child, getting pregnant, having a child to heal a relationship? I mean, it's the same insanity.
Yeah, same. I think that was a prior generation. I think now they're looking for meaning. Because I'm around all the kid shit, and I look around, and it's all like 20-somethings. It's millennials having kids, the ones that we don't come in contact with.
Yeah.
They have jobs, they're raising families, but you can just see this kind of blank look on their face, like, what am I doing?
Yeah, well, but it also does give you meaning. It also does give meaning. It's a millennial
thing.
It gives you purpose.
It gives you daily responsibility.
Purpose.
Let's say.
No. It gives you. It makes your life meaningful in a different way.
I don't think they're transferring the purposefulness to meaning.
Well, I agree with you, probably,
because I think everybody's obsessed with money and fame, like Shelley said in the last episode.
Jesus.
It's all about Gucci bags and this and that.
That's
it's all
so
such
weird
bullshit.
To me. All right. Here's a former paramedic. I have a simple question. Why would a physician give a patient with congestive heart failure albuterol when the patient's having difficulty bleeding? I was trained that albuterol is contraindicated for CHF patients. Astute question. What would you say?
Well, if they're having
bronchospasm,
CHF induced
bronchospasm,
yeah, then.
So, but he was trained not to give patients with CHF albuterol
because it might exacerbate the CHF
or arrhythmias.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So for a paramedic, he's right. You would not want to really give it, but for a physician, I think they're in a position sometimes to prioritize and determine that albuterol may be worth the risk in that particular environment.
It's not. It's not EMT asking this.
A paramedic. It's not absolutely contraindicated.
Right, but in other words, he's riding in the ambulance and he's getting a report of somebody short of breath.
Right.
The doc from the base station is going to say, "Do a breathing treatment,"
and he's going to go, "Why am I going to do this?" It's like the doctor's taking that risk.
But let me ask about that.
Not a risk that a paramedic should take.
Do paramedics assume legal responsibility for their actions?
Well, some, I'm sure, but everything flows to the physician. That's the problem. That's one of the problems with like primary care.
They don't have malpractice insurance, but
part of the insurance, it's part of the ambulance company, but the point is there's no deep pocket there. The physician, my malpractice versus a nurse's, is there's a much deeper pocket to dig into
if you sue.
Yeah, you could sue the, not the paramedic, you
I've
sue
seen
the
that,
ambulance.
Because I was being sued, but they really just wanted that true. I hate to say
When was this?
The Los Encinas.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
and I was scared to death. Shelly was scared. Like, I don't have anything, so I figured, like, they're suing me for $1 million. Fuck them. What? I don't have $1 million. But then Shelly got all nervous because she does own a home and stuff like that.
You have insurance for that.
And then it was, no, but if we were, you know, they were personally, too. They threatened to.
Well, they will. And if you have coverage of $1 million and the jury or judge decides it's $10 million,
yeah, you're screwed.
Yeah.
You're screwed. Okay, here is you're triggering a little thing for me on this is that the way primary care has to absorb all this, and primary care is terribly underfunded and takes all the responsibility and all the liability. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And all the decades I've heard about, you know, oh, we're going to power primary care, we're going to get primary care involved. No, you're not even going to see primary care doctors. Now they want primary care doctors to supervise 15 nurse practitioners.
That's
and take all that liability. I couldn't even read all those records. Forget properly assess what they're doing
in a hospital.
Outside and in the world. In
Australia, there's one attending emergency medicine physician and then mid-level providers. And I've asked the question: when you start bringing in mid-level providers, I'm nothing against them, but what is the balance between the physician and the number of, and
there's a
big backlash. Well, just in terms of, you know, business and industry, business.
Look, I was on Anson Cooper that night, and I go, "Well, when you're going to see physician extenders?" And they went, "Physician extenders? Oh my God! How dare you?" And I was like, "That's the system you put in place. You put this in place.
It's cheaper if you're running a medical system to have them, PAs and NPs.
And the fact is, they can do most of the stuff. I have no problem with them doing it. It's the liability that flows upstream that's got to be interrupted, or else it's just impossible to supervise it to the level that's necessary to avoid the liability.
But,
I mean,
you get into trouble. You have to figure out a way. I try to explain it all the time. I say, listen, doctors are in a tight spot, and everybody thinks they're rich, and they're not. Ugh. But that's a hard sell. But you know, what I wanted to say is I changed my insurance so that I could go to that doctor that saved my life that I told you about, right?
Yep.
So he and his dad are doctors, and they were working like you guys are.
Yep.
And they just said, fuck it, we'll start our own thing. They have an urgent care. They have their family practice, and they're doing great work in my community. And I'm not the only one that changed my insurance so I can go to them.
Yeah.
Right? I think mom and pop docs are going to – don't you think they're going to do something different?
No. They're being asked to take a bunch of nurse practitioners in and supervise them. That's what the system's requiring.
But so doctors are going to step outside of that system like these guys did.
And become you can't do that. Then you're concierge, and then you're ethically out of line, and then how dare you? And that's a different thing.
To have your own urgent care and your own professional's practice?
You're charging people $10,000 a month for that kind of stuff.
No. $2,000 a year.
For concierge?
Mm-hmm. $2,000 a year. Mm. That's usually what it is. And it's sometimes less.
No, it's $80 every time you go to them plus your insurance.
Well, that's not a concierge. That's regular practice.
No, but it's good.
Yeah.
It's way better than the system I had before or before that.
Well, that's just regular practice. And the system as it is trying to undo that, trying to make those doctors.
Well, why won't doctors then leave those systems and start these things like these guys did?
That's still an insurance company paying the bill here. Eventually, insurances won't allow that to happen.
Oh, they won't?
Yeah.
Why not?
Because they'll want that doctor to see many, many more patients per hour at a much reduced rate seen by nurse practitioners.
We need to educate the public about this because I'm still learning.
Educate me about
it. Yeah,
it's hard to know.
These guys left a hospital the dad had worked at and the son was working at and said, fuck it, and started their own thing. And they're
Bob,
great.
Bob, I've been practicing like that as long as you've known me.
Oh.
As long as you've known me. I have, remember that office I have in South Pasadena?
Yeah.
I do exactly that.
But it doesn't have urgent care.
We could do that. It'd be no big deal. But it's almost impossible.
Do you know how reassuring it is to know that if my daughter breaks her arm, I can be there and the doctor I know will deal with it in 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Do you know that people would pay whatever? Bob,
I call and text and email my patients all day, every day.
Well, other doctors don't.
Yes, they do. Done properly, they do.
Oh, he's going to defend all doctors.
No, not all doctors. No, I didn't sell that. I said done properly, they do. That's how we were trained. We're done properly, do. But the practice that I run has almost never made a profit. It's impossible to do it that way and actually make a living. And they're going to make it truly impossible.
Is that what you found too, Bruce? Did you do it before you worked at the big company?
No, I'm in a different situation. An emergency medicine or for a large medical system.
That's
so
a different thing.
I was never in that.
That's a different thing. It's not an internist out practicing in the world. That's standard. That's what we do. That's how we practice medicine.
All right.
You just have to go to make an appointment and show up. That's all.
It's so reassuring. Let me tell you, as a consumer, I am so much reassured that February 1st, I can call this guy and go there anytime. I don't have to worry. He's there for my whole family.
Yeah, that's all.
Well, we haven't had doctors like that, Drew. Maybe they do in Pasadena. We haven't had doctors like that in America for 20 years.
Bob. That's all you had until 20 years ago. Now you have now you have fewer of those. Now you have fewer of those. But that's all you had until 20 years ago. Now you have fewer of those. And the way the system is going, you're going to have way fewer of those.
Do you know why you get so many doctor calls, you guys, that you have your own podcast and all these questions? Because there aren't doctors answering those patients' questions.
Well, having time to answer questions like that is difficult. I grant you that. All right.
It's getting worse.
Yeah, it's getting bad. I just choose to lose money every month in my practice. I do. And just do it the way I'm supposed to do it. That's all. That's the way it goes. Are you criticizing the current Me Too movement? No. You said to a guest on your podcast that young men are terrified of being falsely accused of sexual assault. I've seen that. You said that?
The college campuses have the agreement,
crazy.
Right?
Well, they're like very anxious. They're really trying to do what's right, and they're very anxious about it. On Adam and Drew podcast, you said it's wrong that men's careers are ruined from false accusation. No, I said it's wrong that you can be accused of murder and have due process and get at most 5 years in or 7 years in prison if it's second degree murder. While if you are even suggestive of your hand being in the wrong place during a picture, you will lose your livelihood without due process, without anything. And that's my problem.
But here's
not that it shouldn't stop, not that it's
Let's
not a good
delve
thing.
Into this.
Just there's no due
Let's
process.
Let's delve into this because. Do you really think Louis C.K. is done for the rest of his life? Somehow this whole thing is going to find its own footing and it's going to find its own forgiveness. And 2 or 3 years from now, he will be allowed or whatever it is, right? So will Al Franken. I see Al Franken running again.
What about
or
Garrison
doing
Keillor?
Something.
That show's over.
Yeah, there are certain things that have been destroyed because of it, right? Charlie Rose show.
It's terrible. Although some of his behavior may be worse than
but we know. We're all going to learn as the Me Too movement happens. What happened with Louis is he had this great show with Albert Brooks, which I couldn't wait to see or hear, and it was all canceled. Now people lost their jobs. There's people here relocated to Los Angeles be on that show. The powers that be wanting to punish Louis weren't thinking about those 300 people that had those jobs.
Absolutely was.
And
wrong.
So when I think calmer waters will prevail and we'll talk about these things of what happened as a result of that. It was righteous and it was needed.
Okay.
But now how do we move forward?
So how do we do that? How do we get a due process into this?
I think Al Franken needs to lead the way.
I wish he should not have stepped down.
Bone to pick I have with you is
me?
That woman who accused him.
It's me.
It's your friend. She accused him and in her statement of accusation said she didn't want him to lose his job.
Yes.
What the fuck did she expect was going to happen?
I was there when she did it.
Bruce, what do you think?
Well, Bob.
An unpopular liberal politician in a time of conservatism is going to be kidding?
Right.
She wanted him to lose her job.
I was there that morning, and she did not and was mortified.
Well, why isn't she talking now?
She did.
What did she say?
She went crazy and said, you got to be kidding. This is ridiculous.
And nobody paid attention.
Because you know who asked him to step down? His Democratic
rally.
Just in case more
got. Yeah.
That was a political process. If Moore got elected, his stepping down was going to be okay, now this guy has to go.
See how great we are. Moore's got to go.
Yeah.
No, well, that's politics. But
right, that's
she's
hideous.
The
that's
one
what happened
that
to him.
Caused
hideous.
The balls to fall.
Yeah, but
into
she did
effect.
Not have any intention.
If
not,
you can't,
believe
you,
me.
She once she makes a statement, she can't control that.
That's true. And
so
now
if
she knows.
She didn't want
now
that,
I know.
She shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, is that fair enough to say?
If she had a really, if she had a reasonable belief that that would happen, and she really did not want to, then yes. But she did not have a reasonable belief that would happen. She was mortified and in disbelief when it happened.
In the era, in this political climate, you didn't think he was going to. I knew as soon as
it
happened,
I couldn't believe
he's going to be. He's going to have to resign. I knew it.
I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. I was gobsmacked.
Oh, that was crazy.
Yeah,
that but it was a political.
I remain
what
in denial about it.
What do you guys
it.
Live in? Because he was accused, and they had pictures of him looking all lascivious.
Yeah, he's a comedian in a weird, stupid pose
right.
that she was asleep.
Does the
and
American media look like something that discerns things like that? Not
the
right
media,
now.
No. But people had right to be outraged of it, and particularly to think, you know, how hubristic of people who are telling us how to behave. They're the ones engaged in this behavior. I was outraged. I like Al Franken. He should not have lost his job. That was crazy to me. He should have been before the ethics committee, which is what was going to happen. He should have gone before the ethics committee and had his day in court before the ethics committee and taken whatever punishment they gave him. But his
sacrificial lamb.
He was sacrificed by his party.
Own party.
It's crazy.
But
that was crazy.
If someone return, if someone's ability to be redeemed or to return, like
there's
CK,
no redemption in this.
Well, not redemption.
Not
but I think
now.
It also
now,
depends on your.
But
pattern.
There will be.
Right. Is it predatory? What was the pattern of abuse? You know, someone that was in, tying people
okay,
down.
Okay, so are there two categories of the Me Too movement? Is there the Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer power and control part of the Me Too movement? And then there's the – and Roy Moore might be in that category. And then there's the Al Franken – is Louis C.K. in the Harvey Weinstein category, or is he in the Al Franken category? The things he did were 15 years ago.
Who?
Louis C.K.
You know, Louis was closer to Al Franken. I mean, it was outrageous yeah. and inappropriate.
Those women didn't work for him.
Yeah.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
Right? So
it was an assault. It was an assault of types.
It was gross and stupid
yeah.
and sickening.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have to be able to discern this moving forward in 2018, but 2019.
No, no, it is. And but the issue, though.
Well, you're going to get attacked like this letter.
No, but the issue is that the power imbalance was not properly addressed. And that's the thing we really got to get used to here, which is when can somebody render consent? And I had an attorney I was talking to the other day, and she was saying that, you know, consent can only be rendered if there is not undue influence or a power imbalance, like a student can't consent to a teacher, or a patient can't consent to a police
officer arresting someone.
Right. and an intern and a president or an intern and Matt Lauer, that person cannot consent. And I said, well, what about out in the world? Well, it's a little unclear. I said, to follow your logic, if out in the world that still applies, then rich people can only date rich people and celebrities can only date celebrities then, because there's a power imbalance if they're dating somebody different from where their power situation
or there's
is.
A class.
And
you can't do it out of class.
So what do we do with that? Because I don't believe that. I believe that people should be able to date whoever they want and socialize and be free to do whatever out in the world. In the workplace, no. In the workplace, absolutely not. In a professional environment, I totally get that. So we have to sort of start to differentiate between the workplace.
That was my distinction with Louis. Yeah. These were two girls that he knew. They invited him back to the hotel.
But there was a power imbalance. They were comedians. He's a comedian. They wanted.
They don't work for him.
No, but they wanted. There was a power imbalance still. That's the part that has to be contended with. And I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I think it was the sex also when there was intimacy and a relationship, or was it just a one-night
stand?
No,
that was a miscalculation.
No, but I mean, with anybody. are you putting
yes.
yourself at risk
yes.
if you have a slight power imbalance and you have sex on the first date versus being in a relationship where you could show a track record of
even in a relationship, I would argue that you're misappropriating. That's not.
So what do you think?
Look,
the
new NBC rules: you can't ride in a taxi cab with somebody you work with. You can't hug somebody you work with for more than a second. You see
right.
the rules they put out? Yeah, you can't take a vegan to a steakhouse. That was one of their rules.
You love all this.
Well, I think it's like a physician.
Drew takes the outliers and makes it seem like we all us liberals agree with that bullshit.
No, but I think some of these things are what we would do as physicians with female patients, right? I mean, you don't, there's certain
yeah,
things
that's right.
just don't.
And by
do
the way, I've decided I am an ultra liberal. I've decided that.
You're on the other side of it?
Compared to what's going on right now.
It's fascism, what's going on.
Yes, I'm starting to feel like a liberal. So I want that territory.
He's a progressive.
I want that territory.
He's a progressive conservative.
No, because I like
too many labels.
I think we ought to help people pay for college. I think we ought to give women's rights complete. I think women ought to be the ones determining what we do with the pro-life versus not. Women themselves determine that. I'm becoming ultra-liberal.
I'm scared.
But it's really libertarianism.
This guy is liberalism.
Right.
Here's what I'm fearful of. So I believe that men are in considerable positions of power and hiring power and ownership and corporate boards. So there will be less opportunity for women. That's what I want. I think the Me Too movement has to consider that.
All right, let's get a question here. Are there legitimate 90-day residential Suboxone programs? Our 27-year-old just left his third rehab. He's on gabapentin and baclofen. I'm not a baclofen fan, Bruce. I don't know how you feel about that. I think baclofen's been grotesquely overused. I don't see any good use for it these days myself. For his AS, what is there? Gabapentin and baclofen for his AS are barriers to getting into sober living. For his, I don't know, AS, autistic spectrum? Maybe.
Autism spectrum, I don't know.
You guys talked about this.
Okay. I ask about residential programs because we will not pay for his rent if he's not in a structured setting. Good. On my insurance for now. So I think the question is, are there 90-day residential structured programs that allow for medication?
Gabapentin?
I can't imagine a place refusing that, but I think it's probably Suboxone in reality that they're resisting. And there are programs out there that
allow. There's all of them.
Yeah.
There's a program that quoted you as being their guru.
Are you serious?
They won't even use Suboxone for detox.
Good. I always, you know, when Bob and I were running the hospital-based program, I'd always say, look, Suboxone, benzos, go to this part of the hospital. They'll give you that, the dual diagnosis, whatever. No problem. Go. Here's a good doctor. They will take you up to that part of the hospital to get that kind of treatment.
Yeah, they went right in the same
hospital. We give an abstinence treatment here, strictly speaking, and that's what we do here. We do it well. We do it great, and we're not going
to
adulterate
it with
something
else. Maybe
if
that doesn't work, you know, we're always around. We're always
here. Yeah, try it later. Come back to us, you know, if you want. It's no problem.
And that's the attitude we had about Suboxone in the beginning. Right?
I still kind
of
do.
No, I went really anti it because I felt like, here's my evolution of it, I'll tell you.
It's happened recently because you were anti last time I talked to you.
No, I've been pro it about 3 years now.
Okay.
When used properly.
Okay.
Right? Treatment doesn't work for millennials. It doesn't work like it does for baby boomers or Gen Xers. It doesn't. I'm there every fucking day for the last 19 years. It doesn't click. The biopsychosocial approach to addiction doesn't fit this generation. So those that it does is amazing, but it doesn't fit a majority of them. So we need alternatives, right? Shelley didn't want to say on that show. They don't insist on 12 steps.
No, she was clear about that.
Most places nowadays don't because of the millennials who are just not going to go, and you're painting yourself into a corner. Now, there are the old holdouts that think, like, whatever, you know, that are never going to change. That's fine, too. We need them.
Right.
But Suboxone isn't stepping up and creating its own world. I think we need more sober livings that are Suboxone savvy, Suboxone treatment savvy. We need treatment centers
that
are... No,
not
mostly
so much.
It's,
they're still mixed.
What about Vivitrol monthly injection?
I'm super fan of
right,
that.
Right, me too. And I think it's about as effective.
I want to start. What is the problem with this
Vivitrol injection?
The Naltrexone implants.
Yeah.
I mean, why don't we get those going?
Well,
those
they're going. It's a for-profit company, though. It's very expensive.
I know. There's a crazy thing around
it. The guy wants to be on here. It's a friend of Chris Bohm's. He's got the company.
Well, I love Naltrexone.
You want to have the Naltrexone company guy on?
Well, I'm hearing, though, that they're doing weird patient sort of paybacks and kickbacks, and people are taking them out of their arm and reselling them.
That's what I heard.
You know. Well, Vivitrol you can't take out of your butt.
No, I know. Vivitrol, I'm a big fan. It's $600 a shot, though.
It's
$1,200 now?
$1,300, I've heard.
Oh, my God. That's just, well, why not take Naltrexone every day in a pill?
It doesn't work.
Why would the Vivitrol work
better? But just, it's no better than placebo in those studies I've seen.
I used to use it back in the day, and it had some effect. I won't say it's placebo, but I always wonder why.
If you had a choice between it's your own child, let's say, 19-year-old son, and you have a choice between insisting that he take a treatment that you know is not going to work for him.
Like what?
12-step abstinence-based treatment.
Okay.
Or something that will get him, keep him alive.
Yeah, of course.
Until that's how parents need to look at it.
Right. Well, unfortunately, that's how they do. Then it then becomes
no. They
no
think
choice.
It's a solution for life.
Right.
There's
right,
a
right.
difference.
Right. Right. Right.
It's the bridge to 25, 26, 27,
right.
28, where you wake up and now reality can pierce in. Right. Is that the best way to look at it?
Yes, I do. I hope. It's always a bridge. A bridge is the right metaphor. A bridge right. is the right
but,
metaphor.
But the doctors who are selling the Suboxone, I hate to say it, Bruce, they sell it as like 6 months or a year. I always say, you're going to do it for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, low dose, 2 milligrams, you can get off of it, whatever. You know what I'm saying? They don't sell it like that. They always are in abstinence world acting like they are kind of abstinent. And yeah. 6 months from now, you're going to be just great. And it never works out.
Here's
they need to be more realistic about what is our plan. We have a bunch of professionals here. We're all assessed you. We think you should be on this 4 to 8 milligrams for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And let's get you therapy and get you right.
Yeah. No, that's what I do.
These doctors in the West the Side, Malibu, don't do that. They always act like it's, oh, it's just going to be 6 to 9
there's
months.
One other, there is a scandal in the whole thing, too, that all the Suboxone data and a lot of the Suboxone patients are using some other substance.
If you look at the lot. The pot, a big pot is a big one.
A lot of them are using another substance. They really are.
But pot and Suboxone, they are using it. I'm scared when they use the benzos and they don't tell me. Yeah, I've had that 100 times where they're really taking benzos and they know benzos is my no-go zone.
Look at the Suboxone research. The things I have trouble with is it's not recommended for physicians. It still is not.
But doctors are elitists. They never think of themselves like the rest of us.
The vast majority of the data is done on unobserved urines. The ones that are good and are done on cheek swabs and saliva and whatnot are not done for other drugs. And something like 70% of Suboxone patients admit
that's
to
why
other drugs.
It's only about survival, so, Drew. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's not about not doing pot or not doing coke.
All right, you guys, we got a break. We're going to we're going to switch gears entirely in the next segment and talk about palpitations with Bruce and I. My publicist had a story about a arrhythmia, and we're going to bring an electrophysiologist in here, Dr. Vilma Torres.
Great.
Okay, good.
Well, Bob, do you have us all your – since we're letting you go right now to switch to a medical
topic. Well, I went through a bunch of stuff the last 6 weeks, 2 months, and I'm back at Aloe, the place I started in Malibu, and, you know, they're the best of you know, I just love it out there.
Good.
I love those guys. So I'm back out in Malibu at Aloe. I do the groups. It's fun. You know, I just hate Malibu. I know that's so crazy. Bruce, would you rather switch jobs? Bruce, why don't you go work in Malibu every day and I'll go to San Bernardino?
Marina. I love my patients, but Moreno Valley leaves.
Yeah,
Moreno Valley, desire. Malibu, probably gravitate towards.
Okay. You don't like the taint of Malibu, that's all.
It's just something about it. I don't know, but I'm out there and it's fun.
Take a little break. Be back with a new topic. Well, we're so pleased to have Hydrolite back. Hydrolite is something that we and my family use just about every day, and it is simply the best oral rehydration product I have ever seen. And there are many reasons you should keep some around. I got the flu. I relied on Hydrolite because I knew it would rehydrate me the way an IV fluid would. We all have heard about the flus and the diarrheas, and they all knock you out. Staying well hydrated is critical to getting over these conditions. Even if you manage to avoid getting infected, your schedule is half as busy as mine. Getting 8 glasses of water a day isn't likely to happen. And you don't need it if you've got the proper hydration product, Hydrolite. That is the beauty. Whether you're sick or not, you can absolutely benefit from proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. Hydrolite does this better than a sports drink or water alone. That's right, better. And it comes in great flavors like orange, berry, lemonade. It's available in a premixed powder. Of my personal preference, the little effervescent tablets you can simply drop in a bottle of water or a glass of water, and you're done. You got it, and you are rehydrated. And compared to sports drinks, Hydrolite delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. I know. Don't buy into the hype of the brands. Use Hydrolite. It's a better product. I'm telling you, I had intended to invent it. They got there first, so I'm all behind them. Hydrolite solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. Order Hydrolite today, hydrolite.com/drdrew. That is hydrolite.com/drdrew. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 30% on Hydrolite. We actually buy in bulk in our family. So we're going to click through. Believe me, just click the banner on my site and use the code DrDrew18. That is DrDrew18. Joining us is Valerie Allen. She happens to be my publicist.
Yes.
And she had a little thing with palpitations.
And
then we're going to welcome in a specialist. So quickly tell your story.
Well, first of all, Drew, I can't believe I've never been on your podcast before.
Okay, so we're starting passive aggressive. We're starting with little Soros here. Okay. Well, I apologize.
You know what Adam Carolla says about publicists, right?
Or, she knows because she's been his publicist at times.
Yeah, exactly. It was a very odd thing that happened to me. I went, I think, for a regular checkup. I don't remember why I went to the doctor. And they did an EKG. I was sort of having like palpitations.
You were aware of it?
No, I didn't. I just had like one little sharp pain.
So you experienced it as a pain,
not as an
awareness or
no.
a bump or a
Mm-mm.
okay.
And I thought stress, whatever. Yeah.
Coffee.
Who knows? So I thought, well, I'll go over. They did an EKG, and the doctor said, "So, do you want an ambulance to the hospital, or are you going to drive yourself?"
Oh my god! By the way, that's not you're
curious.
Not supposed to.
And I said, "Really?
You're not
curious
supposed to
choice.
Give. That's not a choice you're supposed to give somebody. Yeah. They either need an ambulance or they do not." But go ahead.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I drove myself to the hospital, Drew. Right. You know me.
Yeah.
I went to the ER, and they admitted me immediately and just started with the test. They ran the EKG again, which I think I emailed to you to look at because I had no idea.
And what did it show? I don't remember.
There was just an irregularity.
Dude, that doesn't help.
Right. I mean, that's what they said. They said it could. They didn't know, so they continued to do testing.
Okay. And turned out to be nothing?
Turned out to be nothing. I did the whole spectrum of tests.
Can you find that EKG for us? We'll all take a look at it. Is it available?
I can try and find it. Yeah. It's probably on your phone.
Thank you. Again, I'm running a podcast. Thank you for the passive aggression. So, did they give it a name when it was all done?
No.
Did they give you any medication for it?
No.
Did they tell you what to do if it comes back again?
No.
Okay. And so it's something you're not even aware of anymore, you don't have anymore, you don't think about it anymore?
No.
Did it motivate you to stop smoking or anything else, being passive aggressive?
I think I had already stopped smoking at that point.
That's the problem.
And
I think,
yeah, that was the problem, exactly.
Okay.
I had already stopped smoking.
So you didn't go to the ER? You never ended up in the emergency room?
No, she
was hospitalized.
You were hospitalized?
Yes.
Yeah.
Based on what?
That's why I want to see what the rhythm is. It's not just an irregularity. There must have been something about it that bothered them. So here's what we'll do. I promise I'll let you go. Before I do, where should people go if they want a great publicist?
ValerieAllenPR.com.
There's where you go. And then we now will talk behind your back. You can go now. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. I have now Vilma Torres. She's a professor of medicine, both at Western Reserve, Case Western Reserve in Ohio, and also here at UC Riverside. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you being here. So I know all of us have giant thought bubbles with question marks over our head. Like, what could they possibly have seen that was ended up being nothing that would have caused them to hospitalize a woman, relatively young woman? Well, I guess the smoking puts her in a little bit of a different category, but I just imagine it would have been little runs of SVT or a PVC, and let's talk about what all those things are.
And I agree with you. I was trying to figure that out because it's a little bit odd, and it's really frightening for the patients when you are told you need to go to the emergency department. You think you're having a heart attack. But I probably think that it's probably a PVC.
Yeah.
Premature ventricular contraction. It shouldn't be said contraction, actually, if you want to be a purist. Being a cardiologist, electrophysiologist, it's a depolarization. It's an electrical. It's an extra beat.
And so let me spell out Dr. Torres. Is an electrophysiologist. Describe what that is to people.
So as a cardiologist, board certified cardiologist, and then we do extra training specifically in the field of arrhythmias or palpitations, rhythm disorders,
so
electrical
rhythm disorders. The way the heart deals with its
electrical system.
And a lot of people don't understand that the heart muscle is not only itself, each muscle a little electrical agent, but there are pathways within the heart that are specialized, the Purkinje system for conducting electricity, and all the kinds of different heart diseases you can get into have all kinds of very complex effects on those systems. Would that be about the way to say it?
So, kind of, yes. And what I try to tell patients is that the heart is like a house, and you have the major frame, and then you have the plumbing, which is the arteries, and then you have the electrical system, because when patients think like her, you have a heart problem, then they think it's immediately it's the arteries. But you can have perfectly normal arteries. You can have a perfectly normal frame, which your pumping function is normal. But then your electrical system is out of whack.
Yeah.
Or transiently, or could be permanently.
And I had a transient right bundle branch, which is a to get a sign. It was when I was lifting weights heavily. I wondered if I maybe had some hypertrophy of the septum or something too.
It's possible.
Yeah, and I remember that. Oh, I've got a right bundle branch. I was one of the little blocks. You're looking at me like, wow.
It went away.
Because it went away. It went away 100 years ago. Yeah, it was present when I was younger, and it went away.
It could have been weight related too.
Weight related.
Which is it all depends.
Now this is a fairly new area of cardiology. Correct? You were one of the first people in the field. Not that you originated. And I'm not making any claims for you. But when we trained a long time ago, there was not.
But then I finished my fellowship in 1985. So it's something that has been developing for years. But I think in the past 20 years, the field has gone from just diagnosis to actually doing more than just giving medications. We actually can fix people, right, which is important about things with technique called catheter ablation. It is a destruction of the tissue. Ablation means just to destroy. Right. So we can actually destroy the abnormal spots. We don't do it for everyone. Not everyone is a candidate, but it's a great option. There's people who suffer with arrhythmias for many years, for decades, you know, and many, especially women, they are usually said, well, it's just hysterical, it's anxiety, but they really I have fixed so many arrhythmias in women like that. And you can actually don't have to take medications for 10 to 20 years.
And premature ventricular contractions, as they're called, even though they're misnomers, are things that are exceedingly common. They're quite normal in a normal heart, though in a heart that has been damaged with heart disease, it may be something different. But in a normal heart, we, as internists or an ER doc, even you see that all the time. It can be very unpleasant. People kind of feel like they're seems to be some sort of endocrine response oftentimes where people literally get sort of right. I had them for a while. I could feel like an adrenaline surge. And it was not just anxiety. I felt like my body was reacting to them. How do we help people understand that when they need to worry, when they don't with these things?
Yeah. So that's very important because we have gone through phases in terms of the medical decision making and what we needed to do. We came through the phase for many, many years ago when a patient has the premature beat.
We treat everything.
And we would treat them and every thought it was life-threatening would get sent to the emergency department, et cetera, because it was going to be a harbinger of sudden cardiac death.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be. But if the patients are having more symptoms, shortness of breath, if they have chest discomfort, if they feel dizzy, lightheaded, then they need to go see their physician. The importance of it is that we don't want to totally ignore them. Lifestyle changes are very important because, like I said, we've gone through phases of treatment. Years ago, we would tell patients, oh, it's a PVC, is it totally benign?
Yeah.
Now we have to be a little bit more careful because if the burden is very high, that we mean more than 10% of all your total heartbeats in 24 hours, then you need to be a little bit more careful because they can lead to what we call dyssynchrony of the heart muscle. That means that you're not contracting. Think of the heart ringing like a towel to be effective. So if you're dyssynchronous, then you can lead to a cardiomyopathy. So it's important to recognize the burden and try to make sure that that gets addressed.
That's a parasystole specifically.
No, not parasystole, any PVC. PVCs in general.
Even if it's a bigeminal sort of reentrant kind of whatever.
So we want to make sure that if you have a high burden because you have too many of these, if patients are symptomatic and some people are so miserable, like you said, oh, they feel every single extra beat, even if it's a few and it doesn't mean that it has to be potentially lethal or bad. Mm-hmm. The danger comes in the patients who don't feel anything. They don't feel them at all. And then they have 20% PVCs. And the next thing, those are the patients I don't want to miss. Right. Her, fortunately, was probably caffeine. It was probably stress. It's all fine and good. The patients who don't feel it, who have a very high burden, who could potentially end up with a muscle disease we call cardiomyopathy.
It causes the muscle, or maybe it's a harbinger of the muscle disease.
That is the question, the chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
It's always been, but I think it's very
clear.
Either way, it needs
careful observation.
It needs to be not observation, but dealing with it.
Yeah.
Dealing with it. So that I think that even the chicken of the egg question is that if you have such a high burden, you do everything to treat the muscle issue, but then deal with that.
So the other thing Dr. Torres does in her discipline is they put pacemakers in and defibrillators in. I remember defibrillators were those giant things in the chest.
Right.
And now they're really, I mean, I think that's been one of the major advances of medicine. People don't give that one enough kudos.
That is true.
Implantable defibrillators. Yeah. I don't know how it's affected life expectancy so much, but I certainly know it's made me feel more secure in patients that have high risk for that kind of thing.
No, it's really a lifesaver. Yeah. The data is very clear for those patients in whom it's appropriate. It's a lifesaver.
In the emergency department, seeing more and more people come in with what you secondary, there's a lot of kids drinking tons of energy drinks, more you know, Starbucks, stronger coffee.
So these rapid rhythm disturbances too.
And then smoking pot, you get, you know, I think I used to read, say, two things that are predictable. You get red eyes and tachycardia, benign tachycardia.
Yeah.
But they're drug-related, and then we have lots. I mean, I'm seeing cocaine and methamphetamine, but a lot of cardiac stuff comes in the ER, and then you're doing your EKG and... I don't know if people miss a lot of that, you know, what the underlying cause is.
Will they miss the substance use, or they miss the cardiac part?
No, they miss the substance use. Yeah. People come in because they have a rapid heart rate, but they're not telling.
Then
cardiac syndrome from drink, alcohol, that's another thing.
Yeah.
Lots of different
people
ones.
Don't tell, and that's exactly correct. And it's not only benign. You know that you have seen people. I have seen people die suddenly from cocaine.
Right.
So and mixtures of all the stuff that is getting really mixed. So it's really a very serious problem.
Yeah.
And many times they come in because of those palpitations. Nothing else brings them into the emergency department except the feeling you're going to die and think you have a heart attack, but no one says anything, and the drug screens are not done, and then it continues.
What kind of advances are there in monitoring and detecting? Because our job is to find out what these rhythms are, is to find them specifically. We have to see them electrically on a EKG or something.
So there's been some advances other than the event monitors. That's what we go to.
Event monitoring means these things you put on your chest and, you know, when you feel the symptoms, but sometimes it's already gone.
It's a tape recorder.
But by the time they get it there, it's already gone. That's the problem I have with it. Or
it's a tape recorder for your heart rhythm. And if it becomes a problem and patients continue to have it, and by the time they get to the emergency department, they get to the parking lot, and the arrhythmia is gone. And they go on, and it's a vicious cycle. For some of those patients, we use loop recorders, which are very teeny microchips. They are about the size, smaller than a little Trident piece of chewing gum is what I tell my patients. And those can be injected almost like with a little syringe right underneath in the area of the chest in the fourth intercostal, the space, and by the breastbone, the sternum, the breastbone. And less than 5 minutes, and battery life is about 3 hours. I mean, 3 years, sorry, 3 years, and you can actually detect all these rhythms.
Do you monitor them on the phone or something? Or
they can be monitored. You know, there's a couple of different companies that have different monitoring systems, but patients don't need to know anything. It heals.
What excites you looking forward in the future of electrophysiology? Because you guys have been able to do so much.
Oh, it's really exciting.
Yeah. What's got you going forward?
It's looking forward to the betterment of the leadless pacemaker systems. We can do them with single leads in the ventricle, but doing the whole systems, two or three leads in a very leadless fashion.
Can you make it so we can keep doing MRIs on our patients? And things
oh, they too? Do can now.
Yeah.
Right
but
now,
even then, they always
are. Right, no. But they are getting much more MRI. Yeah. The conditional devices are better. I think we
I wish they would think about it. They always think about that because that becomes an issue later. You
yeah,
know?
It is. But it's getting to be much better.
Yeah.
Patients need to know that there are centers that can do MRIs, even though they're devices. And so there's a great literature that came out recently about that. They're doing catheter ablations for atrial fibrillation in a much easier way and cure. That's been kind of the holy grail, getting the atrial fibrillation
Which is the top part of the heart, the atrium having irregular heartbeat, not bum, 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 ba, bum. Bum 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 bum. It's bum 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 bum.
Exactly, you got it. And it's the one that is associated with the greatest risk of stroke, and it has to be taken seriously.
The other thing I've noticed a lot of my, particularly women with AFib, get leg edema. Is that something you've noticed?
It is.
I don't. What is that?
Well, I think it's related to the possible diastolic transient diastolic dysfunction and issues.
Yeah, and so for those women, I always thought, oh, I'd like to get them. I should like to get them ablated and fixed, right?
Yes, I think so. I think that not everybody needs an ablation, but it needs to be considered.
What percentage going forward do you think can expect a single ablation curing atrial fib?
The low-hanging fruit patients.
Yeah. If you pick them correctly,
I think that is reasonable to say that it's 65-70%, and for other patients, it could be even a little bit better.
And I think people get a little freaked out about wires in the heart and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
but it's very, very safe procedure, is it not?
Yes, it is.
In fact, you're probably safer sitting there with Dr. Torres with a wire in your heart than running, you know, sprints. Because she can correct anything while she's there. So, well, listen, we really appreciate you being here. Just an opportunity
impromptu.
For us to. Yeah, impromptu. We saw you. We took advantage of it just to do a little primer on palpitations because these are common things people have. With that important, we address.
Oh, I love to teach about arrhythmias.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
That about does it for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Reminder, you can find all the family of pods at doctor.com, the Drew Podcast, Adam and Drew, This Life, Weekly Infusion. And keep an eye out for the new health and fitness show that we have with Mike Catherwood coming your way. It's called Swole Patrol. Mike named it as such. And, of course, our friends at The Last House and Hydrolite. Again, I can't say enough about Hydrolite. It's the best oral fluid replacement system I know of. I like those fizzy tablets especially. And we'll see you next time.
Remember, you can find all these podcasts at drdrew.com. The Dr. Drew podcast, the This Life podcast, and the Adam and Drew podcast, which is available 5 days a week. Find them all on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Subscribe and get it first. And if you're really happy, click on the Amazon banner at drdrew.com to help support the show. We'll thank you for it. If you join the email list via drdrew.com/contact, we'll send you a weekly infusion newsletter with Dr. Drew's news. We're so grateful when you get in touch. We read all your emails and we'll bring you the subject matter you want to hear about.
You live.